Please note that the opinions and perspectives shared on the Real Pharma podcast by Nari O and Ian Wendt are their own. These views do not represent the positions, strategies, or opinions of their employers or any other organizations with which they may be affiliated. Now on with the show.
The cost of doing biotech had dropped, and I was lucky enough to sort of get into this position where we could pitch to the venture capital fund SOSV that it was time to do Biotech Accelerator, and we happened to be right.
This is Real Pharma, your podcast for real conversations with pharma pathfinders. In every episode, you will hear from an industry insider who has a story to share that goes beyond the headlines. No spin, no sacred cows, no hidden agendas, just stories and the people behind them. Now, here are your hosts, Dr. Nari O and Ian Wendt.
Welcome to Real Pharma, where today we navigate the intricate nexus of science, innovation, and entrepreneurship. I'm your host, Nari O, alongside my co-host, the epigrammatical Ian Wendt. Today, we're honored to have a true pioneer in the biotech startup ecosystem on our show, Dr. Ron Shigeta.
Indeed, Nari. Dr. Shigeta's journey is really nothing short of remarkable. As a scientist who was trained in both biophysics and biochemistry, his early career was marked by significant achievements in biotech. But it's his entrepreneurial spirit, I think, that really sets him apart, in my opinion. Ron was the co-founder and science officer of IndieBio, where that team demonstrated the potential of modest investments in fueling biotech innovations that eventually amassed an enterprise value of over $2 billion from just a $15 million initial investment. Impressive stuff.
Seriously. And Ron's contributions also extend well beyond his initial ventures. Since 2019, Ron has run his own accelerator called iAccelerate, where he's been working with highly innovative startups in food tech and biotech.
So Ron, your journey really seems to embody the spirit of innovation, mentorship, and entrepreneurship, which we love. It's a privilege to have you share your insights and experience with our Real Pharma audience today. Welcome to the show, Dr. Ron Shigeta.
Thanks so much, Nari. Thanks, Ian. It's a real pleasure to be here, and it's a real pleasure to talk to your audience. I think that there's a lot of untapped potential out there, and I'm happy to talk about that today.
So maybe you could walk us through your transition from being a trained scientist and, as I mentioned, biophysics and biochemistry to becoming really a pivotal figure in the biotech startup ecosystem. Maybe there's a lot of scientists out there that might aspire to do that, but only a handful really are able to actualize that. And then really maybe focusing on your foundational role at IndieBio.
Great. I think we all sort of get to that point where I was at about 10 years ago. I had been working in a biotech company called Affymetrics for over a decade, and I had done a lot of things there. It was very exciting work, but I was sort of itching to do something else. Synthetic biology had just sort of like come up on the academic scene, and I really thought that this was a good time for biology to sort of get out there and be a lot more mainstream. And I just jumped, you know, and I think it's a lot about timing and luck, I'll have to say. And then when I give a talk, I sometimes say that there are three reasons that I wanted to jump at that moment. And so it's a little bit about having a vision as well. So the three things that have changed about biotech in the past 30 years that sometimes we don't notice is that it's gotten a lot cheaper in three ways. One of them is that there has been so many more graduates coming out of the well-funded NIH programs in all the universities and medical centers, right? And so there's a tremendous amount of extremely well-trained people. They can't all find jobs. And so the availability of labor, skilled labor, is really high. Secondly, the cost of data, this was 10 years ago, so it was very obvious then, and it's super obvious now, the cost of data had dropped by orders of magnitude, multiple orders of magnitude, and it was dropping every decade, dropping again. And then the third thing was that the capital cost of equipment, because of available used equipment and off-patent sort of like processes like PCR, stuff like this, they're all becoming available at cheaper rates. So the cost of doing biotech had dropped. And I was lucky enough to sort of get into this position where we could pitch to the venture capital fund SOSV that it was time to do Biotech Accelerator. And we happened to be right. So that's like my long answer, but it wasn't completely irrational sort of jumping process. You know, I think you have to see things and you have to be willing to follow through on them.
One term you mentioned that I'm not familiar enough with, and maybe some in our audience aren't, could you help us define synthetic biology? I just want to make sure we all understand that correctly, because that's a term I don't hear every day.
Yeah. Synthetic biology is an academic, it's actually kind of a buzzword, but it comes from a mindset which combines engineering, which is very popular with computers and electronics, that sort of engineering thinking with biology. And so the idea, even though it's not entirely true, that you can take one gene and use it as a component in a circuit and swap the circuits around, connect them, and create new things, that was very, very exciting. And it turns out that this is something that, of course, some people have been working on for decades. And it reached that point of maturity where people could actually start to see building useful things. And amazingly, things have happened along those lines. Biology is very unpredictable. And of course, it doesn't work the way you think it does. But we are learning how to make it work, which is why synthetic biology is actually a commercial thing right now.
I wanted to ask you about IndieBio. So obviously, as Ian mentioned in your introduction, you proved that you can take a small investment. And $15 million doesn't sound like it's a small investment, but in relative terms in biotech, that is not a huge amount of money. And you turned it into a value of $2 billion. So that is amazing. How did you do it?
Probably more.
Even better.
Well, I want to get back to that. So the issue was the cost. And I want to give credit to Sean O'Sullivan. So the venture capital firm that funds IndieBio and funds several accelerators around the world is SOSV, which is the venture capital fund started by Sean O'Sullivan, who was an engineer and turned investor and entrepreneur. He loved accelerators and he wanted to do accelerators. And of pretty much anybody in the investment world, he was pretty much the only person who would say, you know what, here's a few million bucks up front. You build the space and then I'll invest cash and then we'll get some profits. That's a lot to take on for somebody with cash, to put their cash up into multiple stages up front before they see any returns. Venture capital is already risky enough. And so there really today, there are very few funds like SOSV, which will actually build spaces where entrepreneurs can come in. At the time, that was extremely important because what made IndieBio a trigger for all of this sort of biotech revolution. And now I have to sort of cap this by saying there are thousands of startup biotechs running around looking for a few hundred thousand dollars in funding to get them started. If you go back 10 years, or even there are still talk of this year, you want to start a pharma company, most people want $4 or $5 million to start. That is a lot of upfront cash. And it's one of the reasons, we'll talk about this maybe later, but it's one of the reasons innovation is so hard to do, because you need to have millions of bucks to pry someone away from their $200,000 or $300,000 a year job, give up all that, start their own company, do their own thing, right? That's a lot of reaction barrier. What you want is you want young people who have really nothing to lose. And they have this idea that's burning a hole in their brain. And they can get an accessible, reasonable amount of cash and they can make a go of it. And that's what's really precious, that IndieBio showed that. The economics of doing that was important because actually my teammate Arvind Gupta actually articulated very well when we got started. It's like, you know what? The capital cost of starting a biotech, if they come into our space, we built a lab. It was adequately equipped to get people started. And then we give them a couple $100,000 cash. And they didn't have to build a lab. They didn't have to wait for the contractors to finish. They didn't have to learn what the code was. They didn't have to source the equipment. They come in, everything's there, just like they just left their lab bench at the university, right? And so that sort of removing of the barrier entry, so like lowering that reaction barrier, was key to get everything started. And once it was shown that, hey, you can actually end up with a unicorn, just the starting cash can be just a few $100,000, that really changed the economics of everything. That's really what happened. It was really an economic demonstration as much as it was sort of tapping into this sort of all this talent.
I mean, it sounds kind of revolutionary the way you describe it, because we, I think, sometimes have a warped sense of how much money you need to get anything off the ground. And you, of course, in the headlines always hear about the big funding rounds and so on. But what you're proposing is you really don't need to start there if you have the infrastructure set up. But for some reason, that didn't seem to be a commonly held idea.
It was completely not held by anybody. And that's what, you know, and I'm saying this now looking back, but I don't think any of us, including Sean O'Sullivan or, you know, Arvind or Ryan, my other teammates, I don't think any of us really knew exactly how this was going to turn out or exactly what our advantages were at the time. But looking back on it, you can see that the economic rules of starting biotech change. it's still different between pharma and sort of synthetic biology. And that's sort of something worth talking. What are the difference in those two opportunities? A lot of your listeners, they'll be inclined toward doing one thing or another. And they're very different sort of paths.
Can you outline a little bit for us those two different pathways that you just mentioned?
Yeah, so I think, and it's a bit about understanding a little bit of venture capital, and I'm happy to sort of give a quick outline to everybody. The venture capital 101 for synthetic biology versus pharma are the amount of time it takes to get to market. Really, that's the fundamental thing. If you want to take some sort of therapeutic to market and you want to work on cancer or something like this, it's going to take, if you are on a super, super fast track at the FDA, right? It's going to take 6 years just to get through the clinical part. And so if you have to do pre-screen or development, looks like 10 years to cash. And then after that, there's actually manufacturing, all kinds of things your team may or may not know about, right? So either the team's got to be really, really strong and it takes 10 years, or you're beginners and you're not drawing such a great salary, but it's taking 12, 14 years, or you're hoping to get partnered or purchased by a major pharma, okay? That's a long time to get your money back. And so you'll need more money. You'll need to burn more money over the extended timeline. And you'll need to have a bigger gain on the end of that to make up for the lost time. And so the economics of pharma startups are still fairly different. There are some exceptions though, right? But they're fairly different from venture capital backed startup. So conventional venture capital backed startup is more like a Silicon Valley Sand Hill Road kind of venture capital firm. They are used to seeing you going to IPO within 10 years, preferably 7, right? So that's not going to happen for a healthcare company. It's possible for a device company, but the profit time ratios are different again for devices. So you have to sort of be prepared for the different strategic timelines and obstacles you're going to have. The venture capital backed startup, which is what IndieBio really popularized for the most part, we did little pharma, but 80% of the portfolio was consumer focused things where there's going to be no FDA requirement for passage. Food, for instance, was our largest vertical. We did over 12, but food was our most popular vertical. And as long as you're actually working with molecules and proteins and biomolecules related to food, they're already precedented. They're already food. There's no question that you're going to, you know, if you have collagen coming from a fermentation process, maybe recombinant protein, and you're putting it into food, there's no question there's going to be any extra toxicity from that. It is atom for atom what you get by sort of like making a pork broth or chicken broth, right? You got collagen in the water, you're drinking it, that's it, right? So we knew the regulatory process was not going to be so arduous, but there turned out to be markets where there are advantages to using basically biotech, pharma tech type of technology, which was well precedented, well understood. And because these people were pioneers, they basically made a lot of hay in a very short period of time and popularized some amazing ideas at the same time.
That's great. I mean, I think that's really, for at least me and probably a lot of our audience, is a unique perspective on how we think about biotech startups. And I think that's a whole nother perspective and dynamic to consider that really does represent innovation. So I love that. I want to drill in a little bit in terms of your capital allocation decisions or how you make those decisions. So I think you've been involved in mentoring or supporting something over maybe 100 startups. There's probably a variety of factors that you believe might contribute to a startup success. And you touched on a couple of them. Like, I like that picture you painted of the bright-eyed, idealistic young scientist, right, who has this idea burning in their brain and they need just an opportunity to explore that. But there's certainly many other criteria probably beyond that, I'm guessing. I wonder if you can, how do you gate those? How do you evaluate the opportunities? Because there's always more hands out than there is money to fill those hands. How do you make those decisions?
Well, I mean, as a science officer, I was responsible for a lot of the technical diligence, especially in the first 60, 80 companies that came through IndieBio. The important thing is to see, can we work with these people? I think a lot of people are coming from highly technical sort of pharma backgrounds. We've had MDs, we've had pharma people come through. The question with these kind of applicants or academics, for instance, the question for these people is, can they have the psychological mindset to meet the sort of requirements that are going to be expected of them to be successful? If there's no point for an investor to invest in someone who we don't believe will be successful, it's a waste of their time. It's definitely a waste of our money. And I think that until you've been through the experience, you really just don't know exactly how it's going to play out. So our experience was a really key point to that. The second thing is the technology and the value proposition of the company. being an accelerator or being an advisor, if they see the wrong market, if they have a strategic flaw, and I believe they have a good enough relationship that we can work on that together, we could work with a team that didn't really understand what they were doing. But there's this phrase in investing that I'm not sure entrepreneurs ever hear, even though it's said many times, the word's coachable. If you have that kind of relationship where you can hear, you don't have to do what everybody tells you to do. That's not a good idea either. But between sort of like, I know everything and I know nothing, there's this sort of beautiful middle path where you take in information like a sponge and you have the discriminating power to find what's best. And that makes you go faster. That means your path is clear. So we want someone who's personally clear in their perception so they can move quickly. We also want an opportunity that we see can return a good return, right? And for venture capital, since the risk is very high, we expect to lose 70 to 90% of the money. That one company that comes through has got to make 20-fold returns. 50% of that is just to make it for all the people who didn't quite make it through. And the rest of that's the profit, right? That's sort of a minimum byline. It's 10x, 20x. There are many companies. There are companies that make 100x. That's what venture capital is all about. You do everything you can to sort of find the people who have the best chance of being successful that way. And so those are all the factors, right? There's the personal factors, and then there's the technical business factors.
On the personal side, though, you mentioned mindset. So what is the mindset that you're looking for, like for a first-time entrepreneur, right? This isn't their third or fourth startup. How do you figure out, do they have the right mindset or not? Because that may or may not be coachable.
That's exactly right. People talk about ageism with entrepreneurs. I don't really have that. It's pretty clear statistically that people who are more senior, who've had experience in industry, who've had work experience, they are more successful more often. However, they can be more stubborn and more set in their ways, you know, but not everybody is. So right, there's this sort of happy fraction of people who are looking for help and they know to be their own best counsel, but not to sort of look down on something that contradicts how they see, right? And I don't think that really is true just for entrepreneurs. Like anybody who has a job in industry of any kind wishes their boss was like that. But we all know that a lot of them aren't. So I think we know how, if you think about it, how common is that? It's probably one person out of 20 that really has that right mentality to sort of be a lifelong learner and humble. And even though they're really smart, to constantly recheck their assumptions and recheck their corners. If you're a SWAT leader, if you're a pharma VP, if you're a startup captain who's trying to sort of like bring a new attack on cancer, all of those people need to remember that they're doing something they've never done before every day, right? Those are the best leaders. And so everybody wants to invest in the best. But your mental attitude when you're running the company is far more important than when you're just sort of running in management at layer three. You know, you're a VP or a senior director. It's very, very different amount of risk to the company.
You just mentioned the two components, right? What is the company trying to achieve? And then who are the people around it? And we all know those are really important components. If you had to choose, would you over index on one or the other? It's a little bit of an unfair question, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
People do, because you're right. Getting both of those in one offer is extremely rare. And sometimes just to sort of keep the business going, you'll constantly go with one or the other. I don't think anybody has a bias toward one or the other. There are some ideas that are just so incredibly fabulous. People will not even look at who the entrepreneurs are. They'll just put the money down. That can be a mistake. We all know that. But you just sort of say like, well, gosh, these guys have to be extra incompetent not to turn this into a successful business. I'll take a risk on that, right? But it has to be an incredible, you'd have to really screw this up kind of deal, right? So there's spectrum on both sides. And then there's some people who literally make $1 billion out of nothing. And this is an important sort of insight into how venture capital works. There are cases where companies have gone to billions of dollars and then they've gone out to the public markets and then they've collapsed. Electric car companies, I won't name names, may do that even though they're in public markets. Their car is out there. There's one of them that is selling a car where they lose like $100,000 or more per every car they sell because they don't have a big factory yet. You know, so, you know, will that happen? The fact is that once everything's gone onto the public markets, the venture capital investors have gotten their return. And so there are places where a company can last long enough and then implode. But everybody really wants a company that's going to want to be an Amazon, be an Apple, be a LinkedIn, and just really become something that everybody will go to their grave saying, like, I'm so glad I was part of that. It's still pretty rare. You know, I think I've got, if I'm lucky, I've got three in my portfolio, my career portfolio, maybe four, but very likely I have one. You know, 100, I mean, you need to get one of those every 50 or 100 investments, and then you need some others that don't lose money. And that's generally how it works out. And you can still have a very hefty return if that's how the distribution goes. And that's often how it goes, because entrepreneurs often don't think about all those little things that cause them to be failing. And so it lowers their chances to succeed. The main reason we're all in here is because of ideas, right? I think there are a lot of people out there listening to you guys every week, and they're thinking, gosh, you know, this is just like an amazing thought I have. And I really, I listen for someone else to have it every week, and I never hear it. And it's brilliant, but they just don't know how to sort of get out there. The system is built for people like that. And so, you know, we're not talking to everybody who's listening to the podcast, but there are probably a few people out there who are thinking, oh gosh, that's for me. Everybody is rare in the business. The people who actually get investment are rare. The people who succeed are rare amongst the people who get investment, but it's worth it. And that's the bottom line, is that that really allows change to happen in a world where it's hard for change to happen. And pharma is a place where change doesn't happen as quickly as people want it to.
So, you know, what strikes me is your risk tolerance level must be much higher than the average person. I'm thinking, given your chosen career path, we kind of talked about how to mitigate risk upfront through the due diligence process before you write the check. But now you've committed, right? You've written the check and somebody's out there trying to bring this thing to life. How do you mitigate risk, or manage risk, maybe is a better way to say it, on an ongoing basis? Because as you said, 90% of them probably are going to fail. At some point, you have to decide where to pull the plug and cut your losses. A little insight there would be interesting, I think, for the audience to understand, because we always hear about the check writing and then we hear about the success, but all the things that happen in between those two points is sometimes a little bit fuzzy for us to understand.
Mm-hmm. I meet investors and I meet startup people frequently, and there is a lot of mystique, you know, and I think I can clear some of that up. First of all, it's incredible to put your feet in the shoes of an investor, because a lot of funds only specialize in small investments early on. For instance, they actually don't participate later on. So it's a lot like having a kid go to college. It's sort of like, okay, I'm done with you. I've put everything I have into you. Goodbye. Hope it works out, right? And so that's kind of the time that you're engaging with somebody in the early stages is incredibly precious to your long-term return. And being able to maintain a good relationship with those startups is important to your long-term success and your long-term reputation. So I think if you want to sort of make your early investors feel good, try to get people you have a good relationship with, who you like to talk to and who you will talk to and partner with. That's a great way to help have confidence from your early money. Those people will then introduce you to people who are the next level up, and those people introduce you to people the next level up, you know? And so those $500 million funds, they don't have time to talk to a $20 million fund or a $50 million fund. So it is this constant social climbing, if you will, that goes, but it's also a way of understanding people. Those relationships keep you alive. And that's often something entrepreneurs have no experience with, right? A really good entrepreneur, from my point of view, is someone who's highly technical, who really has a new idea. But once they embark on this process, they have to become a people person. They have to become a relationship person. They have to become a money person. That is part of it. If you are always afraid of those transitions that's going to happen, that means you just haven't sort of gotten comfortable with that role yet. I think that's one of the things I like to do in my early time with my startups that I work with. I like to get them comfortable stepping into the next level role when they're going to have a board. They're going to have people who are their boss, even though they're a startup CEO. They're going to be talking to lots of people and learning how to convince them of things, not just saying the same thing over and over again. Being a little more charismatic, being a better communicator, and learning to lead. There's so many things you have to learn as the company goes from 2 people to 30 people, from a $3 million, $5 million valuation to 50, to 100, to 200,000, 200 million. All of these valuations are so different. It's a completely different job.
It's a tall order, right? Because the product is not just your product. You're the product too. And
that's right.
As you said, you don't really learn that necessarily when you're in academia.
Nara, you should. I hope everybody heard that because it's absolutely true. One thing that's great about Peter Thiel's book, Zero to One, is it basically, if you read it right, you sort of realize, yeah, my startup just took $5 million and my company's tentatively worth $20 million. But the real value of the company is zero, right? Because I have no revenue yet. I have a good prototype or whatever. I've got this concept worked out in the lab, but I'm really worth zero. And so the real assets of the company are the people in it and the progress they're making and the speed at which they do that, right? So yes, you have to really remember your fundamentals. And when everybody's telling you how freaking wonderful you are, it is hard to remember that. It happens. It's sort of like gold fever when people get their a few million dollars for the checks and say, I'm a startup CEO now. And you're like, well, you're still Jill or Bob, you know, let's try to remember that. It's easy to lose track.
How hard was it for you to make that transition?
I discovered that I love risk and I love exciting things. Like most of the companies I work with are sort of like first in their field. We funded the first lab-grown meat company. We funded the first recombinant protein meat food company. We funded Synthex, which is making a new class of drugs. And they have a completely different way of doing things. So even if it's in a well-established field like cancer, the approach is really, really different. That is really not for everybody, not even in venture capital. I think that really, really new things are actually very hard. They're a special problem that you have to sort of deal with. So it kind of depends on how unique you are. Fortunately, as far as venture capital money goes and investment money goes, there's actually a lot of room for a lot of different sort of like levels of how novel you are or how sort of really on the bleeding edge you are. I think now we see there's hundreds of cell therapeutic companies right now, whereas a few years ago, it was just a couple, right? There's all these fast followers, and that's perfectly legitimate use of money because we need a lot of cell therapies. But for that first time they got a T-cell, modified T-cell receptor out there, it was not easy. And convincing people must have been extremely difficult, right? And once it's successful, lots of other money follows.
And on a personal level, how hard was it for you to make that transition that you just described other people having to make?
You know, for me, I'm ashamed to say it was not hard at all.
I had a feeling.
I had all this seniority. And I think about T. Gondii a lot. You know, the parasite? You know the T. Gondii story? I remember having cats as a child. I'm like, that must be it. There's this parasite that it's usually transmitted from cat to mice. You guys, and the mice, once they get it, the parasite wants to go back in the cat so it can breed properly. And so the mice lose all fear of cats. Even they're attracted by the smell of cat urine. And so they wander out there in the middle of right in the open, right in front of the cats. We got T. Gondii. It turns out that people, when they get T. Gondii from their cats, they also lose a lot of risk intolerance. They tend to take more risk. And so I think about that a lot sometimes.
So your cat gets a lot of the credit here? Is that it?
But, you know, there are people like me. I've met them. And, you know, it's an incredible feeling to sort of be on your own doing something you really believe in. And I don't think you actually have to have a special infection to understand how that feels. And I think there's some people who just really love to do that. And I probably have a lot of that as well. And there's some people listening who are hearing me and they're going like, oh yeah.
Let's get a cat.
That's who I want to talk to. That's one step toward the business, really. Because you don't enjoy it. Some people hate, like, I don't really know if I'm going to be having this job in a year. I really don't know this experiment that we're doing. Everything's going to happen if it succeeds, if it fails, or it's kind of in the gray area. We're going to have more uncertainty. Like some people just cannot handle that.
Many people.
Yeah, that's not your thing. That's okay. Don't force yourself to do it because it causes problems. It can cause some blood pressure surges for sure.
So earlier you kind of talked about how it's a little bit like as one of your investments, one of your companies kind of grows, they graduate and you send them off to college, like that kind of idea. A little while ago, we actually had Jim Trenkel on the show. He works over at Novo Holdings, which is a large kind of active VC firm in the biotech space. So I just want to make sure I understand the landscape correctly. I mean, you're kind of earlier stage startup incubator, and they would graduate maybe to somebody like Novo. Or is that, am I thinking about that right?
That's right. And it pretty much goes by the size of the fund. So I love doing VC 101 with people. So, you know, basically, there's sort of this secret about venture capital funds. And the secret that venture capital and startups have that nobody seems to acknowledge is that they have no money. You know, I think a venture capital fund is someone gives me, if I'm a small fund, venture. Some people give me $10, $20, $30 million. That seems like a lot of money. But if I spend most of that money myself, I'm not a very good investor, right? So I'm probably only going to spend 2% of that a year on maintaining my salary, maintaining the operations. It's just really, they try to keep that margin as small as possible because it lowers my return, right? And so the conventional percentage, 2%, can be a little higher. $10 million, that's basically $100,000 a year, right? It's just not, you know, $200,000 a year. That's one not such large salary, right? And that's some flying expenses, right? And so you sort of understand that their budget is, again, mostly it's just the investors themselves in the fund. They're the main asset of the fund. And so if I have $10 million and I'm giving away, I'm investing $9.6 million of it, I'm not going to write very many $1 million checks, right? Because that means anybody who dies is a substantial loss to the investment. So I try to write checks that are smaller. So basically, every fund will write maybe 50 or 100 checks out of any given fund. The fund will last for 3 years. Then they'll try to go back, show the returns, show the performance, and get another round. Hopefully be larger. Hopefully you keep ramping up the size of the fund. But for every fund, there's a right fund size. Because if you've got like 4 or 5 people or even 20 people, and you're writing $100,000 checks and you've got like $70 million or $100 million, you will simply not be able to put out enough money. And the return, like even if somebody gets 10x, it makes no difference to $100 million. If you write a $100,000 check, you get $1 million back. Your investors will be like, what is this? Right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
Right? That's 0.7, like the 1.3% return on the whole fund. That's not good. You know. So anyway, the fund size determines what kind of check they can write because there's simply, there isn't enough efficiency to handle lots and lots of small checks, right? And sometimes people will do that just to sort of stay with somebody. They'll sort of recognize a long-term relationship and they'll write small checks and then they'll come back and hope that to be in the A or the B round where they might write a $5, $10 million check, right? But those are relatively few. And the thing to remember is in those cases, the small checks are essentially a throwaway part of the fund. You're trying not to put too much energy into that. It's just there to sort of like create relationships that might be strategically important later, but it's not the business of a large fund.
Yeah, I think that's a great distinction to understand because I think maybe as somebody outside of your industry, we just hear VC, we just think that's all of you guys who have money that write checks, right? But it is a little more nuanced than that. And there's different size funds and different roles and different stages, I think, that the different funds kind of participate in. And I think those are some interesting nuances to understand. So I think we would characterize you right over on the left at the earliest stages, right? Is that the best way to think about the work that you do?
Yeah, I'm way in the earliest stages, really the earliest stages. Like usually my clients come to me, they have just an idea. They haven't even really gotten started because they need sort of to get wings up. We just try to get them taxing down the runway, get some funds to get started and try to work through to the point where they're looking commercially viable for a professional venture capital firm.
I wanted to follow up on something that you said early on, which is your most successful vertical early on was food. You came from biochemistry, biophysics, and you've had all these interesting turns in your life. I don't know if they were all really planned out or if something was kind of serendipitous, but how did you get into food? Because you're still in food, so you must like something about it. Is it just because the barrier of entry or the hurdles are a little bit lower than in traditional biotech pharma, or is there something else there that really keeps you going?
I want to say about 2/3 of my business is food now, and I'd like to see that actually diversify further. And IndieBio, actually, the part of the portfolio I participated in was only 20% food and ag, but almost all of the returns came from there. And so because we were basically the first, that means I'm kind of seen as an authority on food tech. But there was other things too. I mean, I think let's get back to sort of how did I get into it? I've always been a very broad reader and I've been very curious. I'm a first generation scientist in my family. So when I got to graduate school and there's all this stuff I'd never heard about going on there, I just wanted to find out what's going on with everything. I read very broadly. And then actually a good way to sort of dip your toe in entrepreneurship is to just do something really small. Like, I think one of the best days in my life is the day I just wrote a $1,000 check to a landlord and we rented a space and we created an entrepreneur biotech lab. We didn't know what the hell we were doing. It was a garage-sized space. Actually, it was a mammoth space, but we moved and ended up downsizing to a garage-sized space, working with one of the landlords here who's just a sweetheart of a guy. The whole family's open to sort of creating business in Berkeley. I think that worked rather well. We just sort of opened our doors and let people come in and have a lab. Because at the time, as I said before, lab spaces almost impossible to get. Now it's relatively easy to get, right? And when I was there, we started talking about synthetic biology. We started talking about plasmids, genes, and promoters, and all this sort of, it got me back into the bioinformatics that was popular at the time, and all this sort of stuff about making circuits and regulation, which is now very relevant to cell therapies. I think just getting back to that basic, my most satisfying place in science, mastering new ideas and trying to imagine what they're useful for. And so that was a large part of my personality. But I think everybody has something that they really find fascinating. When I meet these people, I'm kind of prepared for it because I know what's fascinating out there. Having worked as a structural biologist, and actually I did X-ray crystallography and we solved molecular structures of proteins and related diseases and things. When the food people came along, what we see are there's a sort of structure biology of food that makes all the texture, makes all of the sort of like cuisine that we have. There's actually really, really deep protein structure going on there, or interaction with complex carbohydrates and all kinds of sugars and all kinds of other things that are happening in the food. The microbiome is a good example of that. But actually, if you think about an egg, when the first company came in, you know, they were actually working with eggs without chicken, and they were sort of looking at the proteins in the egg white. And I was just sort of like geeking out with them. And I'm like, wow, this is a structural biology problem. So if you go to France and you meet a chef who's a master chef at the Cordon Bleu, he has a hat, or she, they will have a hat that has 100 folds around the top. You know, it's that French toque, chef's toque that you see. That's actually constructed. It actually has a meaning. Every fold in the chef's hat is a way of cooking an egg. And the result is a different texture. Those proteins are so versatile. They are so manifold in their potentials, right? That's like fascinating. It's almost as good as hemoglobin. You know, it's really crazy. And so, you know, there's all kinds of functionality there. And as we sort of come to understand in nutrition, those are all molecular phenomena. So for someone who's actually been working in human biology and healthcare, there are some really fascinating things to learn, which is why a lot of the entrepreneurs in food have come from pharma actually into healthcare, especially the lab-grown meat, the cellular meat companies. There's a lot of PhDs and senior people coming in there to do this. And it's good to have them because you need real deep cell culture to sort of make inroads in cell cultured meat.
When I think about the convergence, let's say, of food and biotech, there's certainly the consumer application, you know, what we would see as a product that might be in the grocery store. So you already mentioned one of them, like Impossible Meat. I think that's the name of the company. And they've had their ups and downs, right? I mean, definitely some progress, but probably I don't think it'd be characterized as mainstream yet. But, you know, there's the other side of it too, that the applications that are more directly related to health and nutrition or nutritional support. And I wonder, you know, do you see those as being distinctly different? The first case is more of a consumer packaged good kind of play, and the other one maybe is more adjacent to healthcare specific applications. And I wonder what you see that landscape looking like and where the opportunities might lie.
Like I say, there's two kinds of general strategies here. One of them is to sort of take something that's super hot, find a way to include yourself in the conversation and sort of become a fast follower. We funded the first cellular meat company, Memphis Meats, and now it's changed its name to Upside Foods, right? And it's probably a $1 billion company now. Super proud of them. But there are about 300 cellular meat companies on the face of the earth at this point, right? Now, they're not all going to make it, but some of them will. And they're all there making contribution. That contribution is they're trying a new approach. That is much, much better than having one super great lab, super well-funded, with the best people in the world working on two or three approaches at a time. That's a good place to be. Another thing to do is to sort of have, if you're a second category of innovator, I would say, is somebody who has an idea that's completely unprecedented. And they are coming in with something so amazing, good chance it's going to be a complete failure. But you know what? They love it so much. They've done so much work on it. They've crafted the rationale so much that they have done risk mitigation on this idea. And they come in and they say, hey, this is what I want to do. And you know nobody else is trying it. That's an amazing place to be. I think that's where venture capital becomes part of the virtuous cycle. Funding another cell therapy company is very virtuous, right? But really advancing human knowledge, just the way one might have done when they were in university, but at an incredible rate, right? With funding that would take years and years of seniority to sort of get that kind of money and really make a go of it. Like, that's an amazing proposition. And some people are more attracted to that. And that's kind of my temperament. I wouldn't say it's definitely a better moneymaker or anything like that. But I think the value proposition is very similar because it's fewer hits, but much, much higher value hits.
And how do you think this approach can be applied more to biotech pharma? Whereas sometimes that timeline's so much longer, the stakes are higher, everything seems to take a lot of time and money, or that's the mindset. And I think you're a proponent of it doesn't have to be that way.
There are people who have done amazing jobs trying to find shortcuts. And I think for people who are good at that, there's an opportunity for venture capital funding now. So we're talking about very small studies, compassionate care sort of accelerations, really taking advantage of a class of interactions that people have never heretofore been able to handle, right? So for instance, Synthex is one of the companies that we backed, and the funds have gone in and sort of doubled down on these people more than once. You know, but they came to us and they wanted to work on interfacial compounds, right? They wanted to find compounds like FK506 that would bind to a protein, change the quality of the protein surface with the drug, and then it would bind to different partners, completely neutralizing it or hooking it up to other signaling pathways. In this case, they were able to demonstrate that they could find a peptide that did this in about 3 months to a RAS mutant. And so they could pick out a cell with a particular mutation in RAS out of a co-culture of normal cells. That was extremely powerful. They found a great way to demonstrate it, and they were working on drugs nobody else was actually looking to develop. That was new. And telling it in retrospect, it sounds like there's very little chance of failure. I think that's how we felt when we met them. Charlie and Maria, Maria's the CEO, Charlie's a science officer, but they were fresh out of the University of Toronto. Maria had to go back and do her orals to get her PhD after she got her funding. That just feels amazing to take somebody who would have had to go to pharma and work for 20 years sitting on this idea to get funding in a more conventional way. But because their lead cycle was so short and it was so powerful, you could convince people that they would be able to sort of have spin-offs or ways to co-market, get partners, right, from this kind of thing. And so they were able to sort of say like, hey, you know, we're going to be one of these companies that will have greater value shorter term, and that will present opportunities to our investors. It's not easy. And sometimes they need help to sort of like talk through these things and sort of strategize around finding the right patterns. There's actually quite a few of these cases in our portfolio that I've learned about on how to circumvent innovative ideas to market, but they're still risky. You have to do something about it. You cannot say, I'm going to take $5 million right now, and then I'm going to be a $50 billion company in 20 years. Like, it's just too long. You know, it's like saying after you're dead, you can get your money back. That's not quite right. It needs fixing, you know? And so that strategy is key to sort of taking something really innovative out.
So now that you've kind of inspired and fired up some of our listeners to think more seriously about their ideas and take some action, what would you recommend them to do? Like, what are the next steps? You know, for those of you that don't know somebody like you and their first time aspiring entrepreneur, where should they start?
The quick plug is that they can connect with me on LinkedIn, and I'm happy to talk to people. But other things that you can do to sort of like get yourself established, number one is to do a lot more reading. Let's look at some of the startups that are happening and try to learn from, in business school, what we used to call business cases, right? You know, if you watch a company that has an idea like yours or dynamic like yours or choosing a regulatory path like yours, you should learn as much as you can from them. Another thing you can do is you can find a co-founder. And a lot of people who are deep in industry, that's not actually very difficult. Having someone else that you can partner with, that you can share with, that you can sort of bounce ideas off of, get honest critiques from, it's really valuable as a co-founder. It actually drops your risk by 25% or so of failure. It's really an amazing thing to do. If you can't get along with the co-founder, that's also a sign of sorts. So that's one of the early screens that you can do to sort of tell whether or not you really are aligned with this sort of path. And then make a budget and make your scientific plan and see how viable it is. And if it doesn't fit, well, we can talk about it or you can do it again. I mean, if it doesn't fit, go do it, you know, go find another one, right? But doing the brain work, doing the thought experiment is a good step. Really be prepared to engage this.
So Ron, what areas do you think hold the most promise for really transformational impact in the next decade?
My answer to that question is that we are really entering the golden age of biology. If some of us are old enough, we can remember biology was this tiny little department where people would like be looking at mice or like dissecting worms and be pretty damn quiet over there. And now we have reached the stage where we know so much. I'd say we have the alphabet and we're starting to put together words and sentences now. And that is accelerating. And so what we're finding is that biology is connected to every product that we make and we consume, every action that we do in our lifestyle, certainly everything that we eat, many things that we breathe and drink, the diet, our clothing, how we exercise. All of these things are becoming biotech companies now. There was a report from McKinsey about, I think it's 2020. They looked at several hundred business cases and they found 400 business cases and a minority of them were in pharma or healthcare that biotech as it existed in 2020 could impact fundamentally. The potential for this was so unbounded that the report basically announced the 21st century as the bio century. And so the real opportunity here for the listeners is to engage whatever they really find delightful. If you can see the connection, you might be very, very special. And right now we're sort of in a second wave. We're coming from food has sort of had over $10 billion of venture capital investment in the past 5 or 6 years. Fashion and beauty and wellness are sort of coming through. And that will probably continue to sort of continue. Like chocolate's part of that. Fashion, leather is part of that. Cosmetics and beauty are part of that, right? But there are other markets after that that are also going to be coming. And so you don't really have to say no to an idea that you love. You just have to work on it and make it happen. I want to pitch the food a little bit because we didn't talk about that much. I think that, you know, another reason I'm really, really interested in food, even though I'm actually doing a little less food in terms of my advising right now, is that it's the largest scientific challenge facing humanity today. You know, I love cancer. We know it's a really, really important problem. It still stands alone in terms of its technical virtuosity required, sort of like make an impact there. But most cancer therapies will have an incremental change in the life extension pathway. Most therapies will improve someone's life 6 months, a year, maybe 2 years. That's great. Even if it's 5 years, fabulous. But if it's one particular cancer where you sort of made an impact like that, the number of people affected is a certain amount, which is non-trivial. I don't want to diminish it, but it is all of the cancer is just this tiny drop in the bucket compared to the climate change problem. And there are technical advances that we need to sort of keep moving this along. So I think that's why I'm still very hot on food. And I can see right now a good startup that is really sort of like tackling a new sort of like perspective on the environment and sustainability has an impact that, to be honest, makes the next success in cancer therapies. It's just really, really small compared to the impact that you're going to have. You know, I think there's one of my favorite companies I'm working with is part of a wave. There are quite a few of these companies, or like 5 or 6 of these companies that are working on chocolate. Chocolate has every year there's less ground in the world that actually can grow cocoa pods. And I just found out that the cocoa, like West Africa is one of the largest cocoa sources in the world. Sources, almost all European chocolate comes from West Africa. They had too much rain because of climate change this year. Cocoa pods are rotting and their viruses being transmitted around because of the wetness has sort of created disease amongst the trees. and the cost of cocoa skyrocketing. We knew this would happen eventually, but it's happening right now. And you just think, you know, if you're working at pharma, you're an officer company, you're probably not going to get affected by this. But just think about what it means that a chocolate bar might double in cost someday. There'll be a lot of people, it's inaccessible. It's not the same product that it used to be, where it was almost universally available in the West, right? Maybe you have to have your own job and your own career to sort of eat chocolate regularly, right? But for Planet A, one of the companies we work with, one of the hottest food startups in Europe right now, they have a process to produce it from oats. And they are producing really, I've tasted it, it's a legitimate chocolate, cocoa powder, without using cocoa pods. And there are there's like at least three or four other companies I can name that are doing a very similar kind of thing, tackling this problem. They're going to keep that supply going, and they're going to enable less reliance on Africa and South America to do this. That's valuable. I think the cocoa producers will go on and produce very high-end cocos that are very limited in sort of distribution, and the price should go up. I think there's room for everybody. But, you know, if you want to have chocolate cereal and you want to hand out free chocolates to kids on Halloween, that's a completely different sort of side of our life that could be preserved.
Well, I mean, there are certainly people for whom chocolate is an essential food. But let's say outside of chocolate, I think there's the same applicability for essential foods, right? Well, what most people would consider essential foods, because the climate change issue affects everything.
It does. And I think one of the biggest, I'm starting to do analysis. I'm actually writing a book, and I was doing an analysis of all these recommendations people make for the environment. And, you know, changing your diet can have the same impact as basically buying a new hybrid car, right? In terms of your carbon footprint, right? If you are learning to avoid meat, you can actually reduce your carbon, your individual carbon dioxide footprint by tons a year. And the upfront cost is $20 this week, something like that. You know, to buy a new car, to buy a hybrid vehicle, you know, the Nature Conservancy says $15,000 to sort of trade your car in for a hybrid. That's not my experience. You know, it seems like a little more expensive than that. So I think it's important for all of us sort of look for real ways we can impact our carbon footprint. And food represents an amazing opportunity where there's, if we ask the people making these products to produce better products, we can have basically this change without any sacrifice to our lifestyle, to the way we eat, how we enjoy our food. It's what we've been waiting for. It's basically a no-cost way to sort of become sustainable.
And the other point I wanted to make to kind of bring this back to pharma, which is a little bit more of the core of what we usually talk about. Certainly, when you think about the impact of GLP-1, food is at the center of that, because you're counteracting the effect of probably in some cases bad diet. Or if we can use food as medicine, so to speak, and that's something that we've been talking about for decades, but you also can have that impact on biotech, on pharma, on healthcare.
Working in food has been an amazing chance to actually dig deep into the biology of our diet and how it affects our brains, our development, all the signaling that comes from the gut. The gut actually absorbs all of these prebiotics. They circulate through the blood, and they're communicating in different parts of your body, you know, and I think this is a chance to actually engage that. We were talking about the economics of pharma and innovation. You know, it's one of the reasons you won't actually talk about diet very much, because it's something you're trying to ignore when you develop a pharmaceutical treatment, right? You're just sort of like, this is not diet dependent is really what you definitely want. And so the economics of creating food is so different from having a pharmaceutical that you really can't learn about that or incorporate it until you just engage it.
Well, I think that's a great point to close on. You've been very generous with your time today. We really appreciate it. Just a closing question, kind of ask all of our guests, is there anything, a person or an event that really has shaped or impacted your career, maybe personally or professionally, that you'd like to share with the audience? We always like to leave on that note.
That question makes me think of when I was just getting started and we had just done a couple investments in food. We were invited to a conference in Texas. And, you know, it's really an amazing experience to sort of cross cultural lines professionally. And so here I am there, and it's actually put on by Whole Foods, put this conference on. And they put it on because even though it was a very, very successful company at the time, what they really cared about was the food system. And that made a huge impression on me. You know, the CEO came out, opened the talk. We actually had the reception at Whole Foods headquarters, and we had a whole weekend. The conference was called Escabona. I don't think it's being done anymore because they got purchased by Amazon since then. But I met people from all over the food industry. And the amazing thing was how much they really, really liked what they were doing. It's a hospitality kind of business. And the way they interact is a lot like working at a therapeutics company. They've got, you know, therapeutics people have their patients. Food people have their guests, the people that they're feeding. We were thinking long-term. What Whole Foods wanted us to do was think, what's the long-term security and health related to the food industry? How can we all sort of talk about that? And they did it without any specific agenda. I just thought that this is a business that really is an amazingly caring business. And they do that for their own benefit. I mean, you can't really poison your customers and expect to last long in food, right? So it sort of opened up the whole world where, you know, there is this sort of thing where food is tied to the well-being of its own customers. And that sort of opened up this whole idea that I love, that food is a very special place. It's a special product, and that I can get involved in that and sort of help with innovation there. It was a real connection. I hope that everybody out there sort of feels that way, connected to their work in that way, because it's just an amazing feeling.
Totally agree.
I think you said you wrote a book.
I'm just about done with my draft on this book, and I'm sort of taking along that sort of feeling that I got from Escabona, and I want to sort of give the average person access to like a view of what it's like to be an insider in the food system, and why the earth is really not just, it's not just sort of like tied to the food system. The earth has become an integral component to our food system. If you actually look at the mass of matter moving through the earth creates life mostly by fixing nitrogen, for instance. And about half of the nitrogen that's used in biology, in living things on the face of the earth, is manufactured by industry now in the fertilizer industry. Without that, half of humanity would starve to death, right? So we are this sort of, food has become an industrial process and it's become part of the ecological food system. It's scary. There are way too many people, but it's also an opportunity to sort of consciously live in a way that can be sustainable and sort of demand products and sort of help to create products even that get us to carbon parity and get us to even kill on living on the earth. And that's what the book's about.
Well, wonderful. Please let us know when that comes out, and we can certainly add that to the show notes. And we'll also, for those that might be interested in reaching out to Ron, you know, we'll put his LinkedIn profile there as well, so you can find him. I think you can also learn more at iaccelerate.tech. I think that's the right website.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you so much for the time. This is a great discussion, a lot of fun. I learned a lot, and best of luck to you and all the ventures that you're supporting.
Great.
Thank you, Ron. It was really a great pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, another really unique and captivating guest, at least in my opinion. I think a lot of the world that he operates in is pretty different from ours, right? And you might hear about it, or you watch Silicon Valley, maybe on TV or something like that, and you think you know what's going on over there, but that's certainly not the complete picture. But you know, what I found inspirational hearing directly from Ron and somebody in that position is just how magical, let's say, that is, where you find the right person with the right idea at the right time in the right environment with the right funding, and these things can come together in a really powerful way. And you know, you think back even to the genesis of companies like Genentech and other large biopharmas that we don't think of in these terms anymore, but a lot of them started, their genesis was just the way that Ron described. And yes, the failure rate is high and the risk is high, and boy, the payoff on the other end is certainly a lot of fun to think about. And I hope there's a lot of other great budding entrepreneurs out there that were inspired by Ron just the way I was.
Yeah, it was a really fun conversation because it went in so many different directions. Just listening to him describe his path through all these different verticals, I thought it was really interesting. I also like that he was so positive about everything. I mean, despite the odds that he described himself and the risk and what must be a lot of disappointment along the way too. I think he just has this, you know, optimism that it's all still worth it in the long run, and his openness to really talk about things and break things down for our audience, and his ability to just maneuver through all these different areas, I thought it was really, really fun.
Yeah, a lot of fun. The companies he supports are certainly lucky to have him, and iAccelerate, I look forward to learning more and following along with their success, and look forward to seeing Ron's book when that comes out. So we'll provide more information on that when that happens.
I agree.
All right, another fun episode under our belts. Thank you, Nari.
Thank you, Ian. See you next time.
Thank you for listening. Please visit us at realpharma.co for more valuable resources. Real Pharma is brought to you by Black Canyon Ventures.
And that's a wrap on today's episode of Real Pharma. We hope our dose of pharmaceutical discourse has left you in good spirits and has increased your titers of knowledge.
Absolutely. If you found today's pill-packed adventure as stimulating as a shot of epinephrine, we'd love for you to show us some brand loyalty.
Yes, drop us a like and leave a review. It's the best prescription for podcast success.
Think of your review as the little booster shot that keeps our show in tip-top shape.
And hey, don't just keep us as your secret remedy. Share the good vibes and let others in on our Real Pharma therapeutic sessions.
So hit that review button like it's the perfect cure for a long commute. Your feedback is the treatment that keeps us going.
Thanks for tuning in. And remember, an episode a day keeps the boredom away.
Stay curious, stay healthy, and keep this podcast prescription handy for biopharma stories and insights.
See you next time.
Bye.